Welcome to the Ladies of Liverpool podcast.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Ladies of Liverpool.
With Leanne Campbell.
Happy International Women's Day, ladies. Welcome to today's podcast. It's going to be emotional, but it's going to be inspiring. So find a quiet space to digest this lady's journey in her own words. How she found the strength and the courage is an inspiration in itself. And it definitely proves a mother's love is irreplaceable. She faced rejection over and over again, but she won a battle to save lives, all in the name of her son, Michael. It's time to meet my Lady of Liverpool. It's Frances Molloy.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Honoured to have you on the podcast. Doesn't even come close. Frances Molloy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me.
Not many people hear the name Frances Molloy and don't know what you've been trying to do for so many years. But I think today, on International Women's Day, we need to just sit down and break it all down. So, first of all, tell everyone about your Michael.
Well, Michael was a musician and he was a guitarist and he was a producer and he loved music. He'd been playing a guitar since he was 12. Mm-hmm. And he knew from a very, very early age that he wanted to write. So Michael came to me when he was only 8 years old and said, I want to be a writer, because he loved to read. I mean, he was an avid reader. And don't get me wrong, he wasn't a geek in any way, shape or form. He was completely nothing like that.
No.
But his love of reading, I mean, everybody who knew him would say that there was very few books he didn't know about. We used to go to every book signing in this city. It didn't matter who it was.
Yeah.
You know, he'd read the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings by the time he was going to secondary school.
That's amazing.
It's just, I mean, I haven't, and I don't even know if I could, to be honest with you, but we've got the house, it's just full of his books everywhere. And he, you know, he's about 12 and we had a family party and my sister played guitar, my ex-brother-in-law played guitar. And Michael said to me, can I get a guitar? We bought him a, got him some lessons, and he was just a natural.
So this gorgeous boy of yours, who's an absolute dream and doing so well with so much to look forward to, you obviously would have watched him. I just imagine, you know, what I see in my son. And you think of all the amazing things and opportunities that could come his way. And then...
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I went to every gig. I've been to every... I mean, places I didn't even know existed in this city. You know,
followed him around.
And I would go in, clearly not dressed always for the place that I was going to. And the bouncers on the door would say, you've obviously got to be with the band, you know, because you've got to be one of the band's mums. And of course, I was like a peacock going, oh yeah, I'm the lead guitarist's mum.
Yeah.
So I
just
went
proud
to,
as
just
anything.
Just proud. And we, you know, I went everywhere. I think there was only one place I didn't actually go where he played in the whole town.
Yeah. So the world's at his feet.
Yeah.
And he's got the support of his family and everything should have gone in a totally different direction than the way it did. Yeah. But one day, he walks out the front door, you say goodbye, and the worst happens.
Exactly. I mean, he had written a song which did eventually chart. We released it after we lost Michael, called Rise and Fall. It was a double-sided song, and Hope You Know. And there was a producer, actually, who'd come up while he was in Bestival, who was really interested because he'd heard the song and... Yeah. He thought it was good, and Michael never got to hear any of this. So Alex, who sang on the song with him, was who met the guy from London. And I'd said to Michael, don't go to Bestival. Mm-hmm. It was all very rushed because it just been his 18th birthday, so of course he had money.
Yeah.
And he said, no, Mum, I've got, you know, Zach's got me a ticket, who he was travelling with. And he said, you know, Stevie Wonder's the headliner. Yeah. I just want to go. So it was all very, very rushed. But I remember saying to him, well, why don't you just leave it? See what this guy's got to say. And he just said, well, Mum, you know, at the end of the day, if they like me, they'll come back. But I'm not chasing things. You know, he really did believe in order to make it in music, you had to get a following. You had to do it the good old-fashioned way.
He was grassroots, wasn't he?
Oh, he was absolutely grassroots.
He was doing every gig. He was performing wherever he could.
Yeah.
And off he goes this day. And in your own words, because we've all read about it and, you know, we've all seen what the papers print about what happened. But as his mum, who knows exactly what happened, just talk us all through the events of that day.
It was a Tuesday morning and it was about 7 a.m. and I was getting ready for work and my eldest son, Joe, came in and said, have you heard from Michael? And I said, no, why? And he said, I need you to sit down. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, there's been a crash and Zach's been airlifted to hospital with a broken back. And I was like, I just went to pieces.
Yeah.
I called into work and said, I'm not coming in. At no point did I even think that anything really serious had happened to Michael. Mm-hmm. Because the fact that Zach's parents knew, I thought, well, I would know.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe he hasn't got on the coach and, you know, maybe there's some mistake. I just couldn't work it out. And of course, we couldn't speak to anybody to find anything out. So we just rang and rang this helpline, which failed abysmally.
Yeah.
We rang, I think we must have made, between all of us, we must have made thousands of phone calls to find out where Michael was. And all I would get from police handler at the end was, somebody will call you back, and nobody ever did.
And all you're hoping for at that moment is someone to give you the news you needed.
All I wanted to know. And I was
saying, have
you told the families of those who've died? That's all I need to know. Have you told the families? And all I would get is, somebody will ring you back. And then there was one point where Joe managed to speak to somebody who had been on the coach. And obviously that person, we don't know who it was to this day, and that person obviously didn't know who Joe was. It's all very confusing how it happened. And they just said to Joe, a girl called Kerry and a lad called Mick has been killed. So I was sitting in kind of the back living room of my house, and you can see into the garden. Joe was in the garden, and I just seen him fall to his knees and he howled. It was horrific to hear him. And he was saying, it's him. I was saying to him, well, his name's Michael.
Yeah.
His name's Michael. Mm. It's not him. And just this absolute, no acceptance at all coming in. We went back in to watch the news. It was headline news all day, you know, and I saw it was like an out of use ambulance in the background. And the superintendent who was in charge of the scene was saying, you know, we're removing the body of a 20-year-old male. And I just remember thinking, well, Michael's only 18, so it can't be him.
Yeah.
And after Hillsborough, the police would never, ever make such a big mistake. Allow me to watch this unfold on TV. So we decided to just drive to Surrey, but we had no idea where we were going. There were 7 hospitals involved. I think there were 2 police forces, 2 fire services. We just didn't have a clue. So we just thought, head to Surrey.
So you're collecting these little pieces, like a jigsaw from TV. You're trying to put them together, but hopefully not make the picture that it seems to be showing you.
Yeah.
And then you jump in a car, not knowing where you're going. And that is exactly what a mum and dad would do.
Well, there was Michael's dad, Joe and Liam, and my brother-in-law who drove us down there. Mm-hmm. So the whole way I was on the phone, the whole way. And Joe and Liam were sitting either side of me, and they just had their heads up against the windows, just not speaking, like not able to deal with anything. And I'm in the middle saying, you know, ringing people up, pleading with them, begging them, bargaining with them on the phone, saying, just, can you just tell me this? I know you're not allowed to give information away, but can you just tell me, to the families of those who've been killed now? And the whole time I really believed, because no one had informed us, and given that he was travelling with Zach,
it can't be him.
And then the police come back, I think, and said, oh, Michael wasn't on the coach. So there was that sense of relief. So eventually I contacted Joe Anderson, and I contacted everybody in my phone book, really, all the counsellors, business people. And I just said, I'm begging with you, please just help me find him.
Yeah.
So Joe did, to be fair. He emailed Surrey Police and said, you know, this woman needs to find her son. In fact, on the way down there, I'd spoken to Zach's parents, who had just arrived at Southampton, where Zach was having life-saving surgery. They didn't know he was going to survive. I actually said to them, can you wake him up? Just wake him up. Please just wake him up.
Yeah.
Because I need to know. I just need to know. And they said he's kind of prepped for surgery. He's been anaesthetised. And I was just desperate, you know, to... Mm-hmm. And then eventually somebody rang us and said, you know, to head to a hospital.
Yeah.
Which we did. And when we got there, they said the police would be waiting. So, again, I had no inclination, I'm quite... People tell me I've got a sixth sense, but I didn't feel anything.
No.
I had no idea at all what was, you know...
Maybe being a mum, that is almost a way of... It's almost self-preservation of that moment. Maybe you cut off your mum's spidey senses to keep yourself going, to get yourself... You've got to get to a certain place, and to see those police then at the hospital.
There was a moment in the car, which all of us were there. So, you know, I saw him. I kind of saw him. It's hard to describe. I saw his face and I felt him and he was just smiling. And this panic came over me. And Michael's dad and Joe and Liam said, "What's the matter?" And I couldn't tell them.
No.
They were saying, "What's the matter?" And I just shut my eyes and I was saying, "What was that?" I believe that I did see him. And it was almost like he'd waited for me to get to Surrey because he knew I couldn't have made that journey.
Yeah.
Had I known before.
Yeah.
And when we got into the hospital, we went in and the police arrived and he said, "I need you to sit down." And I said, "Just take me to Michael. Just take me to Michael. I don't want to sit. I don't care where he is. I don't care. Just take me to Michael."
Yeah.
And they kind of had to force me down. And he told me, he said, you know, he was killed instantly. And he's still got the scar. I literally dug my nails into his face and just literally clawed his face with just complete shock at what I was hearing. So, and then another policewoman arrived and she came in and she just said, "Oh my God, I'm ashamed of this police force today, what we put you through. This is just horrific. I've just listened to the call logs. There was literally, I couldn't get through them. There was that many."
Yeah. And this is where another story
begins. I mean, I thought it couldn't get worse. We insisted that we could see him. That was a challenge, but I was determined that I needed to go and see him. And reluctantly, they let me.
Mm.
All I was worried about was that he might not know what was happening. So I was kind of really trying to stay calm because I was worried he'd be scared. And I kept saying to him, "Well, he's going to be scared." And
everyone
was looking
instinct.
At me crazy. Yeah. And I said, "You know, we don't know. Well, none of us know what happens. We need him not to be scared."
Yeah.
Because Joe and Liam said to me, we were so shocked. I broke down and I was distraught, but my instinct was to protect him because he might have been scared.
Yeah.
I can't even put into words what it was like to actually see him and be faced with it all. But he was mine.
Yeah.
So that's all I get. He was mine. I didn't care about his injuries. Didn't care.
No.
I just needed to touch him. I needed to see him. I needed to kiss him. I needed to hold him. And, you know, against, I think, a lot of the protocol, they let me because I think they wouldn't have been able to get me out of there, to be honest with you. But it is an instinct, you're right. It's a mum's instinct, is that you just want to protect, and I didn't want to leave him.
No. You love them before they're born. You're there from the minute they start moving about, aren't you? It's you and that baby, and
exactly.
I think that must be the same thing.
So we stayed, and I said, "I'm not leaving him here on his own." So we stayed in Surrey. Joe and Liam went home, and we stayed down there until the coroner released him. And then we drove behind him the whole way. And at one point we had to separate. And I was hysterical. Yeah. I was absolutely hysterical. And
so
the police were trying to pin me down. And
You want to be with him every single step of the way.
I just wanted to go where he was and stay there.
Mm.
There were two young police officers who were driving us. And they were literally like holding me down in the back seat. Because the thought of him going and leaving us.
Yeah.
A lot of that period is a real blur following that because I think I had a breakdown of some kind and my eldest son and me, both of them were just awful. My eldest son particularly was ill. So I had to. He brought me back. He brought me back really because he'd just given up.
I've spoken to other mums who've lost a child and more often than not they say the only reason they're still standing, they're still functioning, is the other children.
1,000,000%.
Yeah.
1,000,000%. If Michael had been my only child, I wouldn't be here.
No.
I absolutely wouldn't be here. But, you know, there's only three choices you've got. You either give up or you take your own life.
Yeah.
Or you carry on. I mean, that's it. And really, when you've got two other children, you've got no choice because you can't pick what any over because you love them all exactly the same.
Ladies of Liverpool.
You had something else in the name of your Michael to keep going for.
Yeah.
And that's your big fight.
Well, I didn't know that until it was 2013. This was a year later when we had the inquest.
Right, okay.
And unfortunately, we had to do that horrific drive to Surrey again. I didn't know what to expect. The police had been to see me to say the cause of the crash was a blowout.
Mm.
And that was all they said. And the weather conditions had been good, but the rest of the detail would come out at the inquest.
Yeah.
So I took a barrister with me, largely because I wasn't convinced about how the police had handled it, to be honest. And
yeah, you had all these questions.
I had all these questions
that.
And all these suspicions and all this mistrust. So I took a barrister who was very good. And when we got to the inquest, it was the same thing. He said, I need you all to sit down. And I thought, that feeling. And he said, the tyre that killed Michael was 19 and a half years old, but it's legal. And Joe was just distraught. He was saying it's older than him.
Yeah.
This can't be right. This just... And he said, I've never heard anything like it. I've never dealt with a case like this before, but it's legal. So, there are no age limits on tyres.
So they just wash their hands of that then and say, it's legal, book closed, that's the end of that.
That's the end of that. So he said, it will come back accidental death. And I said, absolutely no way.
No.
Absolutely no way. And he said, unfortunately, that's what the coroner will return his verdict with. So I need to prepare you now for that. Mm. So we had 2 days of sheer hell trying to argue the case. The rear tyre on the coach was down to the cord. So it was illegal.
Yeah.
They were fined £4,500 for that, the Hannels of Merseypride. They didn't come to the court, by the way. They didn't come to anything. They didn't come to the inquest, didn't come to the magistrate. They didn't come to the public inquiry that followed. They never turned up and they didn't have to. They just sent representation.
So why do you think that was?
I think they were afraid of the publicity that it was surrounding it.
They were just trying to step away from
it. I think they knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, my absolutely... And I have no problem saying it anywhere publicly. They absolutely knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
That coach had every tyre was old. Even the spare was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
They disconnected the air conditioning to save fuel. So what we found out subsequently at an inquiry through the traffic commissioner was that at any one point, this company had 55% prohibition notices on them, 72% at one point. And the national average is 19. So, you know, on that, you could say up to 3/4 of their vehicles were unsafe. There was something not right. They carried on trading. And after the crash, given that Michael had died, Kerry was 23.
Yeah.
The driver, one of their own workers, had died. They were operating the next day. They carried on like nothing had happened. So I was told by the police that what would happen is that they would go in and they would have everything seized that day. The police didn't actually go in that day. They went in a day later, so 48 hours passed. And David Hannell removed all of the paperwork from the premises, which I can't believe is even legal.
No.
And his excuse was, I was getting them all in order for you.
Right.
So that you know, but actually, God knows what he was doing with that information.
And so what do the police do there? They obviously then smell a rat, don't they? They've obviously...
Well, the problem we had, there were two police forces here. So we had Surrey Police and then you've got... Well, the Merseyside Police weren't involved at all. But information was going backwards and forwards. And you have all these agencies. So you've got the DVSA and then you've got the police and then you've got, you know, the police investigation and all these different agencies who clearly didn't communicate with each other. They didn't really look at the rest of the vehicles. They concentrated on that particular vehicle and all of its records. When we had the public inquiry, I thought, you know, the inquest, nothing could get worse. And then I hear this.
Mm-hmm.
People had told me I wouldn't get the public inquiry, but I absolutely forced it.
Yeah.
Because there was no way I was walking away from this and allowing this coach operator, who'd already been known to the authorities, to just walk away scot-free.
Yeah.
Since the crash, I've had so many people come to me and say, everybody knew. Everybody knew.
Yeah.
There's been a guy who worked in the industry who said, I used to drive past there and say, someone's going to be killed before anybody does something about this operator.
That must tear you up to know.
Of course it does.
This was just an accident waiting to happen. People were expecting this.
Everybody was expecting something really serious to come out of this coach operator. And the kids that booked it didn't book it because it was cheaper. And this is something that came out in the inquest. They could have booked any coach operator.
Yeah.
They booked this one because it was a local one. And they thought they should give their money to a local operator. And the coroner actually read that out and said, you know, these kids obviously had some form of social conscience. They tried to do the right thing here. And this operator failed them so badly and cost the lives of two of their friends. There were 53 kids on that coach. Mm. And I'm saying kids, Michael was the youngest. They ranged up until about 25, maybe up to 30, possibly being the oldest. To me, they were all
young
kids.
People,
they
yeah.
were all young people who were going to a music festival and back. And this tyre, basically, because it was old, it still had 40% of its tread. So if you look at it, it looks fine. Mm-hmm. But because it's old, it delaminates, and that means it starts to come away. It just starts to unravel, because if you think rubber, that's what rubber does. Yeah. And once it's exposed to the elements, oxygen, rain, anything, that process starts.
Yeah.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
The shocking thing about all this for me is, isn't this where MOTs come into it? Isn't this what MOTs are all about, to stop things like this happening?
What we did find out subsequently at a parliamentary roundtable, which Steve Rotherham called when he was MP for Walton, we uncovered was that operators, these kind of operators, have a set of tyres for the MOT. So they put a good set on for the MOT and take them off.
Oh.
That is common practice in the industry. It goes on. It's going on as we speak now. I guarantee you there are operators out there who've put a good set of tyres on for an MOT and then just stuck an older set on, so that they always pass the MOT. And that was very easily remedied, because on every tyre, every single tyre, even your own car tyre, there's something called a DOC code, and it's a very, very long code, and the last four digits will tell you the week and the year of manufacture. I would encourage all the listeners to just look at it. Yeah. So that last, so if it says 0492, it was made in the fourth week of 1992.
Right.
Our website, the tyred website, will give you a decoder to help you. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have tyres older than 5 years on my car.
No.
We went for 10 years in terms of a ban when we put through a private member's bill, because we were trying to juggle, you know, such resistance from the government at that time, which I didn't expect, to be honest with you, Leanne.
So this is where you've set up then tyred.
Yes.
And this is your way of now joining forces, I presume, with other parents or other families. Or was it just you alone?
At the beginning, it was just me.
Just you?
It was just me. I went to my local MP, Maria Eagle, and we met Patrick McLaughlin together, Maria and I, to see if we could get him to just do something. And unfortunately, he did very little. He just put out guidance, which is the lowest form of intervention, and it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. Clearly, it doesn't work, because even when the guidance is there, the traffic commissioner had guidance there to say this operator was dangerous, but she didn't revoke the licence.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
still carried on.
There needed to be something else.
There needed to be something else, mm-hmm. because the only deterrent for operators like the Hanals is the threat of prison or serious fines, yeah. whatever that is. But what they get, these £4,000, I mean, it's nothing.
No.
They don't, it doesn't, they'll keep doing that because it's of no consequence to them.
No, it just becomes part of your outgoings, doesn't it?
It becomes part of your outgoings. Absolutely. It's part of your budget.
Yeah.
So that's what needed to happen. And so we knew, and I was, you know, devastated when Patrick McLaughlin didn't heed the warning. And he said that they would then commission some research. This was in 2013, and nothing was forthcoming. And I thought that the government would say, this is a loophole. None of us knew it was happening. Everyone I spoke to, every minister, Maria Eagle at that time was Shadow Transport Secretary, and she said, I didn't know this was going on. She said to Patrick, it was on public record, if I was in your place now, I'm in the shadow, I would do this, Patrick.
Mm.
There's no cost to the government.
Yeah.
It's very easy to do because the date's already on the tyre. Let's just do this. And he didn't.
Just honestly.
He didn't. He just put out guidance.
I can't even imagine what's going through your head at this point when you know something could easily be done.
I was so angry. It was almost as if how I felt was, Michael was a statistic, and I thought, never, never in my life, while I'm here, is anybody going to treat Michael like a statistic, as if his life wasn't important. Mm. And because every time I meet these officials, and I do it every time I go, I've got a copy of his CD, the first thing I do is give it to them and say, Michael Molloy is in this room.
Yes.
You need to know that, you know, he was 18, and I need you to know who he was. We are not talking about some person who didn't, you know, just somebody in the distance. He's my son. Kerry Ogden was 23, and the driver, Colin Dolby, all he did was go to work that day.
Yeah.
So nobody is dismissing these three people. And we just then went into battle. I mean, it's the only way I can describe it. Steve Rotherham got a private member's bill in. got through its first reading. It got objected to at the second reading, and then we had a change of parliament. We had a general election, so we had to start again.
Start all over again.
Start all over again.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Now, in 2017, Paul Corcoran jumped on board. He's been a massive help. This was a massive turning point.
Massive turning point. He said, we're going to do a proper launch. I mean, you know, this is somebody who understands how you market.
Yeah.
I'd done so much up until that point.
Yes.
But we needed the following. We needed to get to gain momentum.
Yeah.
So he did, and it was all pro bono. It's the biggest piece of pro bono work I think I've ever seen anyone do in this city. Yeah. I can't even put a price on it,
and
clearly.
Paul, we do need to mention Paul because he's such a darling, isn't he? Paul would message me all hours of the night, personal messages from his phone to anyone who he thought might have got the word out or might have been able to let people know about what's going on. Paul took it on himself almost to be your cheerleader there. He believed in what you were doing. And he did stick his neck out to help make this
absolutely
happen.
Did.
Who else is on your radar where you think this person, you know, couldn't have done it without them? Or because support at this point with anything like this is the key, isn't it, really?
It was. I mean, he gave me a project manager, Zoe Wallace, who heads up his academy. Oh, my God, she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And she just has taken this on. And she's done it on top of a really, really busy day job. And I think some credit to Frank McKenna as well from Downtown in Business, who also helped do the launch alongside Paul in 2017.
Yeah.
Between them, we pulled off this really big launch.
And you've got this team together
now. We've got this team together now. We got, you know, MPs in, we got media in, we got people from the industry in. And then Paul had managed to get a hold of somebody who's to work for him. And she then got National Express coaches, and they announced on the day of the launch they were going to back us. So that was massive.
That's huge, isn't
huge.
It?
Yeah. It was huge.
Yeah.
So all of these things combined, Tired was born, if you like, the whole campaign.
So this is 2017. Tired is now up and running, living and breathing, fighting the cause with all of these amazing people supporting it and building it and pushing it forward.
Yeah.
What happened between then and the news you've been finally waiting for, which was just a week ago, 2 weeks ago?
We'd had this private member's bill again in. Maria Eagle had put this bill in, and she has been very, you know, remarkably supportive. But we had a private member's bill again, got through the first reading, and it was blocked at every single stage of the second reading.
Oh.
So we were blocked 7 times. What happened last Tuesday, I was in work, and I got a message to say that an official from the Department of Transport needed to speak to me urgently, and could they give out my personal number? And I said, of course.
Yeah.
And when the call came through, it was Jessie Norman, who's the Transport Minister, and Chris Grayling, who's the Transport Secretary, both on the line together. The research that they conducted, it was showing that, ageing tyres definitely aren't as safe. Therefore, they were going to go out for full consultation, and they were going to extend it from buses and coaches to lorries, HGVs, minibuses and taxis. And I absolutely couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And my initial feeling was relief.
Yeah.
Because it has just been, people ask me, and it has taken its toll on my health. Physically, mentally, it has taken its toll on my health.
Mm.
But obviously I wasn't giving up, and I never will give up until it actually happens. That day, Paul turned up at my office, Paul Corcoran, and just sobbed uncontrollably. It was just heartbreaking to watch him. Because all of this, you know, his whole team had put so much, this was all voluntary for them.
Yeah.
They just put so much energy into this. And the whole team, he said, were just elated, but obviously upset at the same time.
Mm.
And I think I went from that sense of relief, but then I got really emotional because obviously it's about Michael. And I thought I wouldn't, and I wanted to ring him because the first two people I rang were Joe and Liam.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I periodically do ring Michael's phone. I know, obviously, I know he's not going to be at the end. It's just
what
I need to do.
Yeah.
It's just this kind of not quite ever accepting this.
Yeah.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Time and time again, following the whole journey that you've been through, things have popped up. And for the likes of me who I'm watching from afar, you know, I'm seeing a mum. Everything we do is for our kids. Everything from the minute we open our eyes, everything we do is for those kids.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show, even when they pass, for whatever reason,
the same.
If you've still got something you've got to do for that child,
Yeah.
You're not going anywhere.
Michael is my first thought as I open my eyes and my last thought as I go to sleep.
Yeah.
And there isn't a second. It's very hard to describe grief of a child. I've lost people, I've lost my parents. When you lose a child, you literally do, a part of you dies. Yeah. And you are in another world. I remember almost in the early days having to learn to respond. So when people smiled, I would smile. It was like I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
It's like I'd lost the ability to be human. I was in a bubble. Mm. It was the most scary feeling. I felt like nothing was real. And, you know, that I'd obviously had a breakdown. But that really has never left. I think what you do is you just somehow manage it. Not always. Yesterday I hit a wall. I hit a really, really big wall. You know, I scramble over them. I go round them. Sometimes I can punch my way through them.
Mm.
Yesterday, it wasn't having any of it.
Is this like a come down now of you've almost crossed the finish line in a sense? You've had the news you wanted to hear.
It periodically happens anyway, but I think, yeah, you're right. It's a physical pain. And I will just be doing something like yesterday. I was folding clothes and then I just went, I'm never going to see Michael again. And I just literally had to grip the table
mm-hmm.
and the pain in my chest. I couldn't breathe. And I thought, I was on my own in the house and I thought, oh my, you know, just I've done lots of things. I've had lots of counselling. I've had everything. And I just could not get past this. And it's sheer terror is all I can.
Yeah.
It's terror.
It's that same day being lived.
That same day. And I periodically do that. But I think on this occasion, whilst this has been very welcome news and clearly we're not going to give up and we need to pursue this consultation,
mm-hmm.
it was quickly cut short by the fact that on Wednesday evening we heard that there'd been another crash on the M5 in 2017, which killed 5 people.
Oh, Francis.
And that I was 18 years old and I was devastated.
So all these years of battling devastated. And fighting and even I up until am. The last minute,
yes.
it happens again.
Why did the government not listen to me sooner?
Yeah.
It was my worst fear. If every interview you hear is all I've ever said is, I couldn't bear to think of another mother family going through what we go through because of an old tyre.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's happened again. Mm. And 3 of the family were from Merseyside and they were from the same family, a couple and their mum in their 60s and the mum was 84. And a couple from Bristol in the 40s. The mum, she didn't pass till 7 months later. She was left critically injured. They had their 2 children. I don't know how old the children were in the car, who again were critically injured. And so those children are now orphans and their parents are now grieving parents. And so it goes on.
Ladies of Liverpool.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
We can sort of help you now moving forward yes. by asking questions, yes. by using our own voices now to support that. We've been educated, thanks to Frances Molloy and all of her team, we've now been educated to step up and be a voice and make a difference. If enough of us are saying the same thing and stepping outside the boundaries of just going along with what everyone else is doing, we will make a big change and
we will.
Our voices will be heard.
The only time you will hear about the age of a tyre is if someone dies at an inquest.
Mm.
And with this law, what we're pushing for, the date of those tyres will be recorded at every MOT. So what I talked about earlier where these operators swap their tyres,
yeah.
that will stop
yeah.
because they'll be able to track them.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't be able to do that.
Yeah.
So immediately you're going to improve the safety yeah. on coaches and buses yeah. and all of those vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would say safety has to be paramount and come before any life because you can't put a price on a life. I mean, nobody will ever, ever be able to put a price on Michael's life. And nobody will ever be able to ignore what happened to him
no.
because it could have been prevented. It was completely avoidable.
And thanks to you and everyone around you for speaking up and continuing to fight the fight. You will save lives, inevitably other people's children. You've saved them, the grief that you've gone through.
Everybody involved in this campaign has done that.
Yeah.
Everybody who's played their part, whether it's because you've retweeted something, you've written to your MP, your councillor, whatever you've done, you have played a part in changing this law.
Well, we're gobsmacked right now at that this has been going on. And I know everyone listening is going to be open-mouthed. They'll have felt everything that you've gone through today, tonight, whenever they're listening. I just want to say on behalf of everyone right now, I think I need to say thank you for everything you've done, and thank you for speaking out with us today. And if you want to get involved, you can follow Frances Molloy on Twitter. You can join the Tired campaign. Yeah. If you feel you can help or you've got something to offer, speak now and get involved. Yeah. You are our inspirational Lady of Liverpool. So thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Subscribe now
via the iTunes Store.
Hear more from the Ladies of Liverpool
via ladiesofliverpool.com.